of the 160 kids we've rescued and reintegrated, we've had zero children re-trafficked. And that's really a testament to our incredible Ghanaian social workers who are spread all over the country. And they just do a great job taking care of our families. And all of a sudden, I found myself constantly thinking about this contrast between this life I wanted my daughter to have and the reality of life for all these children. And so I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I was really kind of overwhelmed. And the experts are not the people who have enough money to run for office. Typically, the experts are the people that have, with zero fanfare, rolled up their sleeves and gotten the job done in spite of government help and not because of it. We are participants in life and not spectators. And so many of us wander around as if life is happening to us. And there's a certain amount of life that happens to us, but there's a whole bunch of life that happens because we choose to show up and to do the hard work every single day. And if we take that mentality that life happens to us, and that very quickly leads to a victim mentality, which very quickly leads to us not taking ownership.
With the COVID-19 virus crisis and the number of casualties with the flu, if you have not been looking at C60 as a means to significantly improve your immunities by now, you should be. Here's why. First, a strong and healthy immune system is your body's first defense, and for those with a strong immune system, your body will adequately fight viruses without medical intervention. Second, C60 is safe as long as you are taking high-quality C60 with no added fillers or solvents. Third, C60 is the best means of removing free radicals from your body that exists. It's at least 200 times better at this function than vitamin C and any other antioxidant. Fourth, as Dr. Chu Li stated on a previous show, COVID-19 creates massive amounts of free radicals, which is causing organ failure for those with weaker immune systems. So now it becomes clear you need the best free radical fighter that exists, and that is C60 with black seed oil and curcumin. Why black seed oil and curcumin? Because these two ingredients are the absolute best at supporting C60 to fight viruses and to improve your immune system. Go to sarahwestall.com/shop and learn more about why this formula is so powerful for building your immunities. And it's now available in gel capsules and by diffuser for more serious needs. Be sure to read the research and, of course, use the current coupons to save money when you buy. Patrons also receive a 10% discount. You can find that code at patreon.com/sarahwestall. Remember, keeping you and your family safe is the most important thing you can do. Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have Chris Fields coming to the program today. He is the founder of the Mercy Project, and he also is the author of the book Disrupting for Good. And it's just a perfect message for what's going on right now. The Mercy Project is he rolled up his sleeves, he got involved, and he's gotten 160 kids out of human trafficking. And he set up this whole program for this. And we talk about what it takes to solve problems like that and to be a disruptor for good. And we talk about current issues. We talk about his project first, kind of get an overview, and then we talk about current issues. And then he sticks around for my patrons and does this amazingly good message about how you persist and take responsibility and how you work to be a disruptor for good. And that's the whole message of being an adult and taking responsibility and how we're in a kind of a different culture and paradigm right now, and it's not helping to get us to that point. And he's all about solutions. He's all about changing mindsets to get things done and to solve problems that just seem enormous and unsolvable, but are if we have the right attitude and mindset. This is just perfect. I love his message, so I don't want to take much more time. I want to get into this
great interview. You can see his stuff by joining my Patreon, the exclusive at patreon.com/Sarah Westall. I want to remind you, Patreon's got 10% off of the C60 gel caps, and listeners also have $5 off coupons, and there's also coupons for other things. You can go to my shop at sarahwestall.com/shop. It helps support the program. So everybody who supports it, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Let's get into this amazing interview with Chris Field, the founder of the Mercy Project. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining the program.
You are so welcome. I'm glad to be here.
You run the Mercy Project, and I want to know what that is. Our listeners want to know what that is. And then I want to talk about how you got into this whole ball game and dive more into the topic. But first, talk about your Mercy Project.
Yeah, so about 10 years ago, my wife and I founded a nonprofit called Mercy Project, and we're working in Ghana, Africa, to help rescue children out of human trafficking there. Ghana is home to the world's largest man-made lake, and there are hundreds, probably thousands of children who have been trafficked by their families into working on this lake as, unfortunately, modern-day slaves. And so Mercy Project is going into these communities where these fishermen own the children and force them to work. We're teaching those communities a different way of fishing by using aquaculture cages instead of the labor of the children. And this actually replaces the need for the children and makes more money than the children can make working. And so the villages then voluntarily release the children to be reunited back into their families. So over the last decade, we've partnered with 15 fishing communities and rescued and reintegrated 160 children back into their families across Ghana.
Well, that's excellent. Now, let me ask you, why did these families give their children up to be slaves?
Yeah, so there's a quote that I always use whenever I answer this question, and it wasn't about Ghana, but it's a really beautiful quote that a woman said one time about refugees. And she said, "No one puts their child on a boat unless the water is safer than the land." And in the case of the Ghanaian families, almost all of the children, like 95% of the kids that we've helped, they come from families where it's just a single mom, and either she's been widowed or left, and she's left with more children than she can feed. And so she makes the impossible decision that, kind of hoping against hope, that at least if her child goes to work on the lake, she knows they'll be able to have some food every day because they'll be able to have some fish. And, you know, that they always are hoping that they'll be able to earn some money and go back and get the child back. But of course, just like in most cases with poverty, it's never quite that simple. And typically when we find the moms through our investigators, they have just as little money as they had when they first trafficked their child. And so a lot of our process is actually coming alongside these families on the backside and equipping them to get out of the cycle of poverty. So we do that through microloans. We do that through skill training, job training. Sometimes things as basic as helping a woman set a budget and understanding her income and expenses for the first time. And also we have sponsors to help the children go to school to ensure that at least that expense is taken care of for the family. So of the 160 kids we've rescued and reintegrated, we've had zero children re-trafficked. And that's really a testament to our incredible Ghanaian social workers who are spread all over the country, and they just do a great job taking care of our families.
So now, why did you pick Ghana? Because we know that human trafficking is really bad in the United States. We know it's bad everywhere.
Yeah.
Why did you pick Ghana? And then are you using those, what you're learning, to help elsewhere?
Yeah, great question. So it's not a cop-out when I say this, but I feel like Ghana picked me. I don't feel like I picked Ghana. It was 10 years ago, I read a book about human trafficking. It wasn't even a book about human trafficking, to be fair. It was a memoir. And in it, the author mentioned human trafficking. And one of the places she mentioned was Ghana. And at the time, I was doing a lot of work in America around poverty and inner city work. And 10 years ago, no one was talking about human trafficking. I mean, it was not the buzz that it is now by any means. And I considered myself pretty socially aware, and I was shocked. I mean, we were pregnant with our first baby, and all of a sudden I found myself constantly thinking about this contrast between this life I wanted my daughter to have and the reality of life for all these children. And so I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I was really kind of overwhelmed. So I Googled the author of that memoir and I called her. I showed up in Ghana for the first time 3 months later, went out on the world's largest man-made lake, met some of these children, held their hands, couldn't talk to them, but didn't need to. And my heart was simultaneously broken and captivated. And I came back, knew we had to do something. We started raising some money, thinking we'd give it to another organization, and then realized nobody was really getting at this sustainably. Nobody was really getting at the root causes. And so we made the decision to start Mercy Project. And that was about a year after my first trip. So to answer your first question, full circle, I feel like Ghana picked me. I mean, I wasn't looking for this. Even when I went on that first trip, I was just looking for a way I could respond to a need. You know, I've always prided myself on being the kind of person who would show up, and which I think is half the battle a lot of times when it comes to hard things, is that we're just willing to show up even when we're not sure what happens next. And then once I saw an opportunity to be helpful, I took it. You know, I didn't run away from it. I ran towards it. And the rest is kind of history now, 10 years later. So as far as using what we've learned to help others, certainly I find us being able to do that. I'm pretty regularly throughout the year able to talk and collaborate with some United States nonprofits that are doing work around human trafficking. I will say the work in Ghana is pretty unique across the trafficking spectrum because it's heavily economic driven. And unlike, say, brothels in India or brick kilns or something like that, like the most of the traffickers that we work with, the men in the village who own the children, they actually were trafficked children themselves. And so even with the labor of the children, these guys are only making about $2 a day. And so it's not like there's one person at the top of this pyramid that's just crushing it and everybody else is suffering. They're all suffering together. And so in that way, Mercy Project is a pretty different model than, say, sex trafficking here in the United States, or, you know, women coming from other countries across the world to the United States, you know, and being forced into servitude or something like that. Like, those typically have somebody who's kind of the mastermind or the pimp, if you will, and they're making massive gains because of the women or the men or the children. And in Ghana, I mean, there's really no winner. I mean, everyone's barely surviving. And so it does make a different model, but I do think that there's enough similar sort of characteristics around the work, and they were able to find some ability to collaborate. But the place that I'm most able to use what we've done in Ghana to be helpful is I teach a class at a business school here at Texas A&M University, and I'm actually in my 10th semester of teaching the class, and it's to undergrad business students, and the course is called Using Business to Solve Social Problems. And that's where I've able to be the most effective, is because I can take the model of what we've done in Ghana and we can apply it to those problems that the students feel most passionate about, even if it has nothing to do with human trafficking.
Well, let's look at something that is so relevant in today's world, where we have these cities like Seattle and San Francisco, and where the homeless problem is enormous. I mean, the cities are collapsing almost among, yeah, its, you know, on itself because of the homeless, yeah, problem. And they keep wanting to throw money at it, but it obviously doesn't help it. You know, they're socialist type environments. They're very into helping supposedly, but they're not helping. So what, when you look at those kind of problems, what do you think when you see it? I mean, because you went in, let me see what's different here. You went in and you got that, you rolled up your sleeves and you got it done, and you showed people how to a better way to be responsible and to take care of themselves and to train themselves. What are we doing in these cities wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is, I tell my students in class all the time, the complexity of our solutions has to match the complexity of the problem that we're trying to solve. And if we take a complex problem like homelessness in a large city, and we think that changing one law or changing one line on a map or changing one extra food stamp or something like that is going to suddenly change this complex problem, that's absurd. So first of all, we need to be much, much more deep thinking in the way we're choosing to solve these problems, first of all. Second, we need to understand why poverty in that context happens in the first place. Why are people ending up homeless? And, you know, obviously on this one interview together, we can't solve that entire problem. But I'll tell you this, homelessness begins way before somebody actually becomes homeless. And it's not because there's not enough houses. Now, I'm not saying that sometimes more housing
That's
isn't
fine.
Helpful.
Yep.
Yeah, and affordable housing and some of that. But we know there are a number of key factors that lead to somebody being homeless. Education. We know that there's a disproportionate number of military veterans that end up homeless. And we know that there's a disproportionate number of people in with mental health issues that end up homeless. So it's so often we say, oh, we're going to help the homeless by creating more homes. Well, what if we took that same energy and the same budget and the same drive, and we actually went all the way back and asked, why are people with mental health issues becoming homeless? Where are we failing them before, as children, as teenagers, as young adults? How is the system failing? How are we not solving the problem of mental health in better, more broad sweeping ways? What are we doing wrong with our military veterans that so many of them would end up being homeless? You know, what are we doing wrong in our school systems that so many children would end up dropping out of school? And then because as one key factor in their homelessness is their lack of education, which leads to lack of employment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times we know you have two or three of these things converging at one time, right? It's not one thing that happens. It's a convergence of those things. So I would take this solution all the way back to those starting places, what I would call the root causes. And I would take a hard look at how are we keeping young people in school, particularly those most vulnerable and susceptible to dropping out. And that's going to open up a whole different can of worms, right? And we know low-income schools typically perform not as high as high-income schools. Well, why is that? Is it parent involvement? Is it the lack of experience from teachers because those schools are hard to teach in? Is it a lack of funding? Is it a lack of an involved, you know, parent-teacher organization? Is it because kids come to school hungry and so they can't focus on learning because all day they're thinking about where their next meal is going to come from? I mean, there's 100 ways you could go down that path, right? But if we're not asking those kind of questions to answer a current problem like homelessness, we're just perpetuating in 10, 20, 30 years, the next generation of homeless people are already being failed. We're just not seeing them and thinking about them.
Wouldn't you say that when we have so many suicides amongst our veterans, and we have children that are struggling, and we have schools that are struggling, I mean, I come down to just the basics. I mean, we're missing out on basics like family time and and drugs, and I mean, it just the core basics of society, we're screwing up on that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to get that complicated in the sense we're just messing up on the core values and principles that make things work.
Right. Yeah. And then the question becomes, how do we actually then help a child who's missing that core value of a family unit? Because obviously it's not the fault of the child, right? They didn't ask to be born into that situation. They didn't ask for the poverty that they're experiencing or the broken family that they're experiencing. And so the question is, we have bukus of systems set up in America that should be able to help solve this problem, right? We've got federal funds here, there, all over the place that on paper, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars are being poured into each child from 0 to 18 years old. And if it's not working, then we need to be honest about that to say, what is it about the current system? Because yes, we can kind of bring a renewed focus back to that core family unit. And I'm all for that. I'm a father of four young kids. I mean, I see very clearly how much better they are and how much better our family unit functions when I'm engaged and when I'm focused and when I'm very fully present. I'm not just physically present, but I'm emotionally present to my children. I'm able to really see them, not just visibly, but to see their needs. I see all that, but I also know there's millions of kids across this country that there's not a dad at home every night. And so how do we practically not just write all those kids off, right? But come into a scenario where we're able to come alongside them and to use the dollars we're already spending and to use the programs we already have in place to just do a better job, a more effective job, a more efficient job at really getting at the root causes of this problem. And that's where I think we've got to be really honest about what's not working. We have to stop doing things just because they're what we've always done. We have to stop pandering to partisan politics and really be honest about wanting to create transformation. And that's only going to happen through joint effort and through deep collaboration and partnership. And we're going to have to value those kids' lives. I mean, we're going to have to truly dig in and believe that when we help 1 or 10 or 100 children that are in really difficult situations, that's 1 or 10 or 100 children that we're keeping out of jail and that we're keeping off the streets with homelessness. And we have to believe that and make that commitment before we get to the end result, which by that point, in many cases, unfortunately, it's just too late.
Well, isn't there a time? I mean, can't we, you know, you want to stop the floodgates. So at some point we have to put the fork down and say, we are going to stop the flood from happening. We're going to close this floodgate and help as many of these young ones as possible and help it from more of them being created. I mean, that's the problem is we're so busy fighting the after problems that we're not stopping the flood of new. And the flood coming in is growing. And I believe it's because of all the corruption and all the crap going on everywhere. Money, like you said, we have a whole bunch of money. It's so corrupt that people are stealing the money being honest, in my research, a lot of these front organizations are part of the problem.
Right.
Child Protective Services, yeah, in many cases are part of the problem.
Yeah. I just think there's so many layers, and every time you add a new layer, you invite corruption and you invite problems and you invite challenges. And I know a ton of great, I mean, amazing, incredible social workers that feel like they can't do their jobs because of the layers of bureaucracy. And so there does have to be some sort of tightening of the system, some sort of efficiency and collaboration where there's not 15 layers between the person actually doing the work on the ground who knows the family and who can make a difference, up through people making rules that have never even actually sat in a home with a child that's in child protective services, right? I mean, that it's like government officials making decisions for what should and shouldn't happen in a classroom, and they've never even been in a classroom, right? I mean, that doesn't make sense. I mean, there needs to be, we need to go to the experts, and the experts are not the people who have enough money to run for office. Typically, the experts are the people that have, with zero fanfare, rolled up their sleeves and gotten the job done in spite of government help and not because of it. And those are the people at schools across our country. There are educators and administrators and teachers that could make enormously positive changes if they were given the opportunity. But those aren't the ones who get elected, because you have to have money and you got to play the game to get elected. And most people, myself included, I'm too busy actually solving problems to want to pause for 2 to 3 years to play the game. And so we end up with, you know, I'm not saying every elected official, but too many times we end up with people in office that are really good at politics and not great at solving real problems.
That's exactly what the issue is. And I think they're all pandering to whatever group they need to pander to. And in reality, you just need to roll up your sleeves and get stuff done, right? I mean, absolutely. You just, and what I like about your Ghana story is that you're teaching people to be self-sufficient. You're teaching to be responsible themselves. You're teaching the families to be educated. It's so that they can, it's the same story in the Bible and about teaching them how to fish versus giving them a fish. You know, I mean, it's just, you allow people to be self-sufficient. We're not all children. They need to grow up and be adults. And I think we have this attitude in this country of endless childhood. We always want this overarching state to take care of us, when in reality, we need to take care of ourselves, and we need to roll up our sleeves and get it done. And that's why I like your example so much, you know, because that's what we're missing everywhere, is people taking responsibility themselves and getting things done. Yeah, even in this virus, I'm going to bring up this stupid virus. Right. People are waiting. So many states are complaining, you know, that the federal government didn't give them their supplies. So where are you guys? You have your own, these governors of these states have their own whole healthcare system. Why aren't they ready to go?
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
They should be looking to the federal. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's that constant attitude.
Yep. I agree. And I think that there's, again, I think at the state level, there's so much bureaucracy between the federal government and the state that anytime something goes wrong, everyone wants to look at the person next to them and say, wait, I think this went wrong because you did this and you didn't do that. And there's just very few times anymore where people are taking ownership. You know, it's like I tell my small children, my 5-year-old son this morning didn't want to apologize to his little brother for hitting him. And I said, look, no one likes to apologize. I don't like to apologize. I don't like saying, hey, I shouldn't have done that. You know, I could have done that better. But that's a part of life, is that when we make mistakes, which we're all going to do constantly, is that we take responsibility for those mistakes and we own them and we create a new path forward. We don't just say, hey, I'm sorry. Hey, I'm sorry. Hey, I'm sorry. 1,000 days in a row. We say, hey, I'm sorry I did that. And here's what I'm going to do next time to make it better. And when you live in a culture that, for whatever reason, this could be fodder for many, many, many discussions, we've learned to play hot potato with our problems, to where as long as we're not the last one holding the potato when the buzzer goes off, then we don't have to think about it. That's how we end up with so many programs and processes that are, they're at best, they're short-term solutions. And as soon as something goes wrong, I mean, look, coronavirus, this thing is real, obviously. I mean, I'm feeling the effects of it. in different ways. I've got clients who are feeling the effects of it. I've got donors who are feeling the effects of it. Everyone feels it. I get it. But for years, I mean, years, studies have been coming out showing that the average American has less than 1 month's salary in savings, right? I mean, these studies have been coming out over and over and over saying like, hey, the average American does not have money for an emergency. Like they, you know, I saw some statistic that was like, this is before COVID-19, like 75% of Americans would have to borrow money if they had an expense over $1,000. And so then all of a sudden this horrible thing happens and it's terrible and it's unpredictable and we could have never seen it coming. Fine, I'm fine with all that. But now we're all like, I don't have any money, guys. What am I supposed to do? And it's like, wait, this is exactly what we've been talking about for years. People have been saying you should have 3 to 6 to 12 months worth of savings in a savings account. And, you know, and people will say the dollar has weakened and inflation and housing. And that those are discussions for another day. I will say this. Most people I know, myself included, have multiple subscription services to things we do not need, but that we really like. And we drive cars that we do not need, but that we really like. And we live in houses that we do not need, but that we really like. And we eat food at restaurants that we do not need, but we really like. And I could go on and on and on. And somehow we feel like we're entitled to all those things. And so when someone says, hey, we should have 6 months of savings, we say, I could never do that. No, no, no. I will choose to never do that, because I like how it feels to spend my money this other way. And that's fine when the economy is going well. That's fine when the market is returning 7% year over year over year over year, like it has the last decade. But when it hits the fan, in this case, that's COVID-19, all of those subscriptions aren't going to pay our rent. They're not going to pay our bills. They're not going to put food on our tables. What's going to pay our rent and bills and put food on our tables is if we stocked away for a rainy day, because the rainy day is always coming. The only question is, are we actually going to have an umbrella like we've been told to have for the last decade? And a lot of people don't. And it stinks because it's going to hurt a lot of people. And I hate that.
Well, in 2008, anybody who lived through that and didn't plan is not very smart. But that being said, there are those that live paycheck to paycheck or have medical problems or whatever. That's what it's for. This is what the emergency is for. But for all of those people that were in your scenario that just didn't bother to save, shame on them. Because now we have to bail them out when we could have just focused on the people who legitimately needed it, because they have a scarce resources and they have been living like that for a while and they couldn't help it. You know, medical conditions, whatever their situation is, college students that didn't have help and now they're just trying to dig out of it. Those kind of people. And now we're in a worse situation. But I got to tell you, we also knew for decades now that our immune systems are lower. We haven't been focused on wellness. The CDC isn't talking about building up your immunities. They're talking about wash your hands, stay away from people, and good luck. You know, why? So it's just this whole attitude of not taking responsibility for yourself. That to me is everything that's happening today, whether it talks about, you know, all of our political systems, I don't want to bring up the ugly word of socialism, but it's that same concept. We have to take responsibility for ourselves. Even if you want some of those socialist programs, okay, whatever, we can fight about that later, but nothing works unless you take a responsibility for yourself. And that was the whole point of our country, is not being children. And then if you can look at it from that perspective, then we can start solving problems. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of who's going to take care of me, we're screwed. Nothing works. Right. That's why socialism never works, because everybody gets into that attitude.
Sure.
You just can't have that attitude and have things work. That's why I love your story, because it exemplifies teaching responsibility and looking at problems from a responsibility type standpoint. Because I think that's the source of almost all of our problems right now. And the greed factor on top of that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, obviously tons of compounding factors, but I had a professor once who said something that always stuck with me. And he said, our stories explain us, but they don't excuse us. And literally that was a decade ago that he said that in a class, a graduate school class. And I've never forgotten. He's passed away since then. And I constantly use that phrase because all of us have a story. And that story certainly has a deep impact on who we are and how we function in the world. But as soon as we use that story as a crutch, as an excuse for the next move we're going to make, say, well, you know, I'm going to do this because this thing happened to me. And it's like, wait, you know, in this, I talk about this, you know, I have the privilege of being able to travel around the country and give keynote speeches on this topic of disrupting for good. And one of the things I constantly say in my speech is we are participants in life and not spectators. And so many of us wander around as if life is happening to us. And there's a certain amount of life that happens to us, but there's a whole bunch of life that happens because we choose to show up and to do the hard work every single day. And if we take that mentality that life happens to us, and that very quickly leads to a victim mentality, which very quickly leads to us not taking ownership, and even at a deep psychological level, not believing that we're capable of solving our own problems. I mean, that's my frustration with so much so many of the programs that we've done with low income families in America is we now have generational poverty that we've got millions of people who just really believe they're not capable of living outside of poverty. And I mean, that's a crushing psychological blow to any person to really, like, sincerely, deeply believe they're not good enough to be anything more than they are, which is exactly what they saw when they grew up. And that, I mean, it's crushing. And so when that's your mentality, it's five times as difficult. I mean, I'm making that number up. That's not a scientific number, but it's so much more difficult to get somebody out of that situation when they really, in their heart of hearts, their core belief, they do not believe they're good enough to overcome and to get out of that. You just made your job so much more difficult when we steal people's dignity and we steal their self-worth.
Exactly.
We rob them of that ability to know what it feels like to show up and to do good work and to get paid. And we've robbed people of that. And then we wonder why it just keeps happening in perpetuity. Well, I mean, it's because we have a lot of people in this country who don't even know what that feels like because they've never done it once, much less every day for years.
Exactly. Okay, where can people get a hold of you, learn more about you, get you for speaking or whatever else that you have going on?
Yeah, so Mercy Project, we got a great website that really goes into depth talking all about our holistic process, and that's mercyproject.net. And if folks want to reach out to me directly, I've got a website. It's just called meetchrisfield.com. And that has information about me personally and also how to get in contact with me if somebody wants to bring me in to do a speech or consulting or anything else.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. That's just wonderful. Everything you're doing is wonderful. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to be here and I appreciate you having me on.